This is Games as a Podcast.
Hello, everyone. Eason, how are you?
I'm great, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing also great, thanks. Especially because today we have a guest, David Wood. We both worked with David back in the way back Sega days, where he was a business development manager. He helped line up many of the titles for Sega of America to publish. He's worn many hats in the video game space, from game design to production to publishing. In most recent years, he worked at Meta, where he helped build out their catalog of VR games, supporting the Quest. So many cool experiences. He's a great guy. I really can't wait to get into it. Thanks, David, for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for the intro, Chris. Hi, Ethan.
Hey, great to talk to you again.
Delighted when you invited me to come by. I've listened to a few of the shows, and really great stuff.
Yeah, we have so many interesting stories to talk about, and you were at Sega at one of the most interesting times, I think, for our listeners, because that was the big transition, where we were going from first party with Dreamcast to reaching out and signing a bunch of big companies to make games for us, from Monolith to Gearbox, and just had the remit to Win. I remember that.
Yeah, that's right. Sega has gone through lots of boom and bust periods, and I've been there for several of them. I've actually worked at Sega three separate occasions, and that transition from being a hardware software company to strictly software and really going after whatever it took to get games into the hands of players was pretty exciting times.
I remember the big thing was to find studios that we could work with who had valuable IP when we were looking at acquisitions, and those targets became fewer and farther between very quickly.
Yes, even then, there are, for the same types of cycles that Japanese publishers have gone through in the United States in terms of growing and then shrinking and growing again, we see the same cycle on the developer pool side and the IP side of consolidation and then expansion and rebirth. And that was a period where spending was happening quite a bit on all fronts. And so developers were dropping off the board quickly.
And we would never have thought that Activision Blizzard would ultimately end up being one of those acquisitions. They felt so huge that they were too big to buy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. You know, at the time, I was kind of in support of that acquisition. I felt that a monopoly in games just doesn't really happen. But the way it's been handled, it seems like it was maybe not the best idea for the industry or the people who work at those companies.
Yeah, it's always hard to know. I mean, from a consumer standpoint, it's certainly nice to have Game Pass and to be able to just not have to worry about buying Call of Duty every year because you're just going to get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's an interesting value proposition there, but I noticed in my own play patterns that I don't get the value out of Game Pass that I thought I would because, I have play patterns like a lot of people do, which are I have my go-to games. And then I have periods where I want to try something new. And on Game Pass, that typically involves spending an hour trying to find a game and then running out of desire to play any games and walking away.
I understand that. I definitely understand that. For me, the challenge is simply that the place I most like to play is on the Switch 2. Mm-hmm. So I will sometimes skip big propositions on Game Pass just because it isn't on my favorite platform. Or there are times even when I'll try something on Game Pass because I can try it for free, and then I'll go buy it on Switch 2 instead.
Yeah, that's the ideal customer, I think, for them.
You are the ideal customer for sure. Yeah,
a demo channel, right? Where the developer gets a little guaranteed money, helps them move forward, and then there's actually sales on the back end. I don't know that the behavior is that way in general.
I just have concerns about the business model from a developer perspective, just having seen what the likes of kind of Spotify has done to musicians over the years. I really fear that kind of business model subscription could have or may have similar impact on developers over time. It's just kind of concerning to me.
Yeah, I think fear is the right word because that's what's on the developer side in those instances quite a bit, right? Is here's an opportunity to get some guaranteed cash. It may not be the size of purse that you're hoping for when you're building your dream game, but as trying to be an ongoing business concern, you're going to take some money, but you're also leaving money on the table. And I think publishers understand that. Microsoft certainly operates in that way themselves in many instances where, you know, hey, let's take advantage of the uncertainty of the marketplace for developers and their properties and get their games sort of sewn up or onto our platform so that we can benefit from that. I think in the early days, they were offering really nice princely sums for those titles. But as they grew their flywheel of content, it hasn't been as enriching for most developers.
Yeah, the balance tips the other way. You know, the early days of the Epic Games Store was good for a fair few developers. Similarly, Apple Arcade, and it has shown over time that the balance switches pretty rapidly to those who have controls over the means of distribution, which is not surprising in any kind of capitalist market, I guess.
What concerns me as a player from a content standpoint about Game Pass or similar services is how it might affect design itself. So if you are incentivized to make an endless game because you are getting rewarded based on engagement and how many hours somebody plays your game, that sucks for me because I have no interest in endless games. I want something with beginning, middle, and end.
And is that indeed the business model? I'm actually not familiar with how developers get paid on Game Pass. I'm assuming there's an upfront if your title is new and desired enough by Microsoft. Is it a by use, by hour, minute played type thing?
Yeah, it used to be. I don't know if that's how it is currently, but it was that way a couple of years ago, paid by engagement.
It's interesting because it's almost in Microsoft's best interest for someone like David to pay for the subscription and maybe not get the most use out of it. Because if people are playing a lot on the system, that's costing Microsoft money, right? They're spinning up servers to support it, etc. So it's interesting that they compensate developers in a way that is not aligned with their profits or the way they make money, probably.
In the publishing game, no developer payout is the best payout.
That's true.
And it goes back to the way deals used to be created, where it was an advance against royalties, and it was essentially a loan that the developer had to pay back a fraction of the gross revenue for that publisher.
Yeah.
It just says something to me, though, that Sony and Nintendo have not followed suit. If anything, Nintendo's going the other direction and saying, yeah, maybe $80 for Mario Kart.
Yeah, Nintendo's a bit of an awesome anomaly in the space insofar as they haven't changed a whole lot in the last couple of decades, which is kind of refreshing to see that the market can sustain so many different kind of business models and different things going on. So that there's some hope there.
Yeah, it really speaks to the breadth of players and what they want from games and how they approach games and what they take from those games. It's just, it's quite the palette, I guess.
So, Chris, I know you've mentioned in the past that increasingly you like to cuddle up with a Steam Deck, and now you have your Switch 2. David, I don't know how you like to play. As I just said, I really like playing on Switch 2. So handheld is principal, I think, for Chris and I. What is your pattern of play?
Opportunistic. Just being in the business, you know, I have a Switch. I don't have a Switch 2 yet, but I have a Switch. I have a nice desktop PC. I have a Mac. I have all the consoles. I have a phone and pads, right? So when I have those moments and there's something I'm interested in, I usually just grab the device at hand or a screen that's available since I have a family home.
So one thing I noticed you didn't say in that list was an HMD or a VR headset. So
yes, that is true.
And I don't mean to put you on the spot because I'll tell you, I was raving about the MetaQuest 3 on the show when I got it.
It's
an awesome piece of technology. And without fail, what always happens, whether it's that, HTC Vive, PlayStation VR 2, I get super excited for 2 weeks and I'm using it every day. And then for reasons I can't even explain, I stop. And then it takes me 2 months to get back to it. And then the battery hasn't been charged and I can't find my controllers. And then I'm just throwing my hands up saying, maybe another time.
I know exactly why it's happening. It's because it's an appointment-based entertainment media, right? You have to decide you're going to play your VR. You're going to have to go to your designated little play space, make sure the coffee table is not going to kill you, etc. You have to, it's something that you have to be very conscious and deliberate about versus just grabbing your Switch and firing it up on the couch. So it is, we've talked about it before, and it still is just an amazing entertainment medium because it is really immersive. It's super immersive, but because of that deliberateness, you basically have to consciously decide you're going to do it and kind of prep everything to do it and then go and do it. And it takes you out of, because it's so immersive, it's taking you out of your immediate surroundings. And if you've got things that are vying for your time, it can be very distractive, and maybe it becomes not a choice because you know that maybe someone's going to come walking into the room, or you know that you're doing laundry or whatever. So it requires a special set of conditions to play. And I think that's why it kind of gets deprioritized over time. It's a nice new shiny thing when it first comes out, and then it rapidly moves to the bottom of the pile. That's my supposition.
Yeah, I would totally line up with that. The aspects of gaming and XR that made adoption so slow in the beginning, you know, needing that space, needing that the dollar investment, the friction of just putting that thing on your head, those haven't gone away, even though the cost of entry has come down exponentially. The value for the hardware that you buy when you pick up a Quest 3 is amazing, but it still doesn't take away those problems that you just outlined.
Talk a bit about your experience at Meta. What was the kind of content strategy that you were tasked with, and how did you go about doing it? I'm fascinated to hear about your experience there.
Yeah, Meta is an amazing place. They are in a great opportunity to hire the best and brightest, right? They can afford to pull people in and keep them there. So it's very competitive in terms of the coworkers that you have. But also a lot of great people there, right? A lot of smart people, a lot of people there that want to do the right thing for gamers and are just really interested in tech and want to create amazing experiences. So it's a real cornucopia of emotions and opportunities over there. Our purview there, when I was on the third-party publishing team, and our goal was to bring in as many developers as possible to create that content flywheel, which would have those developers coming back, refining their craft and coming back and building the next game and staying abreast of the technology that we were building and bringing their players with them and just trying to snowball XR content and XR audience. So a lot of what we were doing is focused on bringing flat screen games and flat screen developers into that ecosystem so that they could build great games for our players.
And there are some bangers out there. The Batman game was just unbelievably good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Asgard's Wrath, Assassin's Creed. There's just really solid mm-hmm. games out there from people who have a lot of experience making the flat screen games, as you were saying.
Yeah. And those mirror what you see in console with the first party teams, where if you are a high functioning developer and you have access to deep knowledge about the hardware that you're creating for, you can create some amazing experiences that are head and shoulders above everything else that's on the platform. And those are kind of the ones you just outlined there. Those were very much hand in hand with the development teams at Meta.
So the only challenge I see is, whereas last year I knew for sure that Batman was the big game, and there was some smaller stuff like Triangle Strategy that got me interested and convinced me that there would be more things to play. This year, maybe it's just that somehow, even though I check all the gaming sites and I own all the headsets, I'm somehow not in the loop, but I just don't know what the big game for MetaQuest 3 is this year. Like, that's not something that I'm aware of. Whereas on the consoles, I know to look forward to Metroid Prime 4, for instance, or Borderlands 4.
So part of that may be there was no new hardware this year. They were on a breakneck release cycle of hardware every year, which was fantastic on a hardware side because, you know, better, faster hardware with new features is always wonderful for the consumer. For the developers, though, it was very difficult to build and deploy a game knowing you would likely need to support new hardware. and not knowing what that hardware was going to do and what those specs were, so you could optimize your experience to move forward and compete with games that were going to release specifically for that platform.
How heavy a lift was it typically between hardware cycles for a developer to, say, support one piece of hardware that came out and then to change your game or update your game to support the next?
Yeah, base level, plug and play. They were completely backward compatible. So there was no problem there, and Meta did a great job of developers the opportunity to not rebuild their games to operate on the new hardware. But if you wanted to have those new features, which were always part of a hardware release, right? You have to have something to crow about. Then you would have to take on something new that may not be in your original spec.
Did Meta think that it would likely end up that they'd be effectively the only headset on the market? Because when things kicked off, you had Vive, you had the PlayStation VR, but those ecosystems have effectively collapsed. And I don't think there's a name in VR anymore outside of Meta. And there's obviously advantages and disadvantages to having an ecosystem that you own entirely.
Yeah, that was not expected or desired on the Meta side. We were very much in support of other hardware platforms. And the reason is to kind of go back to that flywheel of content developers and players, right? The more companies you have investing in that space, the quicker that space grows and the higher the quality of the content in that space grows, the more people you have spending marketing dollars to bring players into that type of experience. So the Meta's desire really was to have a healthy, broader business of headset developers and content creators.
So what would you say were your favorite experiences on MetaQuest 3, just as someone from the inside who could play anything?
Oh, you're really putting me on the spot here.
They're all great, let's say that. But the ones that are really good, the most play time.
And I played so many for 2 minutes that it's hard to pick. You know, when you're looking for content, you're looking for partners, and you're trying to decide if something is going to move the needle once it's released, you often don't spend a lot of time with that content. It's really about, okay, there's something here, let's move forward and let the developers and the engineers figure out how best to put that together. It's hard for me to single out a favorite, but I will say that the Assassin's Creed game that you mentioned earlier was really well done and was a real high watermark for the three and took a long time, and it was a lot of heavy lifting to get those things to work.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
So it'd be very sad if the advances to gameplay and tech that were rolled into that were not dispersed and used going forward.
Some of the novelty of the mixed reality stuff, too, I appreciated. Triangle Strategy, again, was a sort of a Fire Emblem type game. Mm-hmm. And you could see your room and it presented itself as just a board in front of you. So that was kind of a fun thing. Angry Birds was super neat to be able to walk around the construction sites and figure out exactly where you wanted to place your birds from a 360-degree perspective. That was very, very fun.
Yeah, and the promise for mixed reality was to come back to Chris's earlier point about putting that headset on, being in a dangerous space, not knowing what's going on around you, and maybe that makes you anxious. For mixed reality, you're still in your space because the cameras are feeding you your room, yet there's this amazing content in front of you. One of the goals we had building content for mixed reality was to get away from that board game type of thing where you're always just sort of looking down. And so bringing elements of your room into the experience and finding ways to expand on your environment rather than just include it into a smaller experience. Wall Town Wonders is a great example of this, if you've seen that one. There's little towns and people doing their things that sprout into your walls. It's very cool.
So one thing that I know there was a lot of excitement about initially was the idea of having the MetaQuest be a social media hub, a place where you would hang out and talk to people. And other companies have tried doing things like that, like VR Chat or Altspace VR, but those never seem to catch fire the way you hope. Even Rec Room, I heard just recently they had to get rid of like a significant part of their staff because it just was not doing what they needed to be able to sustain. Is that just kind of a pie in the sky that's unlikely to ever manifest for whatever reason, or what's going on there?
Yeah, a couple points there. I think Rec Room was going multiplayer. They got some early investment, spent a lot of money. So they didn't quite have that focus on VR that you need to truly be successful in the space, I think. Obviously, you want to go multi-platform at some point to bring in the greatest number of people. And even Meta realized that when they opened up the metaverse to mobile. You can have all those metaverse experiences on your mobile device, and it brings more people in. And so then you have greater opportunity for socializing. And there are some examples of success in their VR chat. It's still pretty successful. The other friction that's there is a lot of times players and people who are interested and open to these new experiences are quite young, right? The audience and the folks that you're interacting with may not have the maturity level that would lead you to extended interactions, let's say, right? If you think about all the monkey games that are on there, and sometimes these interactions are fascinating, right? Sometimes they're completely toxic, and sometimes they're just completely throwaway, right? So the young audience, I think, isn't that interested in creating deeper relationships with a lot of people that they meet online.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I did experience that where I'd actually have a good conversation going in something like AltSpace VR, and then there was just a troll who would come up and make things uncomfortable for everyone, and that is very hard to avoid. That's not the fault of the people putting the platform together.
Yeah, I've had similar experiences for sure.
But remember, even PlayStation was experimenting with this stuff with Home back during the PS3 era. There's always been this desire to create these visual hubs where people could have the social media experience with avatars.
Yeah, absolutely. I worked at a company during the dot-bomb era, and it was very much like in life, but completely UGC, building a toolkit for developers to build their own experiences. It was unfortunate in its timing, and really the only thing that survived were some patents, and one of those patents was for synchronized video viewing, which Sony snatched up and used for Home.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, you saw when you were at Sega this growth in small games in addition to the AAAs. You remember that whole window where Xbox Live Arcade became the savior of the industry, and everyone was trying to get on board that. Yeah, exactly. But it was interesting nonetheless that it was in attempt to do what we're seeing now with Hollow Knight, Silksong, and Hades 2, these smaller scale games that you could get for a lower price, $20-$30, and really enjoy. And I remember Sega really tackled that aggressively. And I know you were a part of signing a bunch of those, weren't you?
Yeah, they did. So I was the junior BD guy, right? I had a boss, and he handled the main titles, right? So that sort of meant that the smaller projects came to me, which actually turned out to be wonderful to the point that you're making there. I got to sign Sega's first Xbox Live title. I got to sign their first Western-developed Sonic title for handheld. I got to sign the first mobile titles, which we worked on together. Being junior in that role really opened up a lot of opportunities and exposed me to types of games and developers that have certainly made their mark on our industry moving forward.
And that was one of the nice things about Sega having all of this valuable, recognizable IP. As an example, we could bring Sonic the Hedgehog 4 to that, and it was meaningful to people. Or you could bring Super Monkey Ball to the iPhone, and that was something that would be a big draw. So that's an advantage a lot of other companies didn't have.
Yeah. The willingness to extend your IP to have a first mover advantage for all these emerging platforms was huge.
Yeah, Afterburner on PSP from Planet Moon, if you remember that one.
Oh, yeah.
And we were very fortunate that Japan was very flexible with us in being able to use some of these IPs with Western developers. Before, that was a much harder thing to do, but around that era, they started to open that up a bit, so long as it wasn't Virtual Fighter.
Yeah, I think Sega is really blazing trails in regards to being a Japanese publisher who had that type of flexibility and desire to expand in those ways. I've worked at multiple Japanese publishers, Bandai, Sega, Sony. And I'll say that one of the differences about working for a Japanese company now on the BD side is that the pace can be quite glacial. I've learned that a Japanese superpower that does not come naturally to Western BD people is the power of no. Saying no to opportunities, saying no to money, saying no to partnerships that may seem advantageous at the time. And this willingness to take the long view and to be protective of the IP that you've built, you know, serves them time and time again.
That's definitely an advantage, though a disadvantage. We've talked about before, BioShock was something that Sega could have picked up.
Mm-hmm.
Except the challenge is the team themselves went into massive cost overruns that Sega would never have allowed.
Yeah.
And so had they signed with us, it wouldn't be the same BioShock.
Yeah, I was there to say no to two very large franchises, BioShock being one of them, Borderlands being the other one. And I came to the, ultimately, I came to the same conclusion after being upset about it for a long time. To the point there is like, yeah, the structure of how we wanted those products would not allow for BioShock or Borderlands because of those reasons. They went into heavy iteration. They shipped late. There was more investment than maybe was palatable to a Japanese company. And Borderlands, I didn't feel so bad about saying no to because at the time, Gearbox was a successful company at making Half-Life mods, you know, great stuff,
yep.
Like very, very well regarded. Mostly the highest regard came from Gearbox, of course, with Randy. But when they came to when they came to Sega looking for a deal, at the time it was called Pandora, which makes sense with all the gun mods. But it was probably 3/4 page pitch. And they wanted $10 million. And that was it. They're like, we're Gearbox. Here's our idea. Give us money. And, you know, that didn't fly with a lot of publishers at the time.
Yeah, that's interesting because they were basically just pitching, sign up for the next Gearbox game was the pitch.
Basically, yeah. And we're going to do it with, you know, a million guns because we have this cool tech that allows us to mod everything. It was a cool pitch. I'll give them that. But to go in and ask for that kind of money with a single page of, you know, text was kind of ballsy.
Ten million seems quaint today.
Doesn't it?
Yeah, it's crazy to even think about that. But it's interesting also that both of those projects went to 2K as well.
Ended up there, yeah. Yeah. Have you had a chance to play Borderlands 4?
Yes. Yeah, I really enjoy it. And I love it for so many reasons, but it's just my kind of grindy Phantasy Star Online style gameplay experience. I'm not a Diablo guy. I don't like how that game monetizes. I have not kept up with Phantasy Star, so this is kind of my type of game. Just straightforward fun. I can play with friends. And I also have a good time since it's PvE with total strangers and usually have pretty good conversations and do that as well. I'm by and large not much of a multiplayer gamer, but that is one that I definitely enjoy.
Yeah, nice. I'm having stability issues with it, but I think the game in itself is a lot of fun. Good movement.
That's your fault.
I know.
Certainly yep. Not the studio's fault.
Yeah, Randy, let me know. I should mention, Ethan, that in my first round at Sega, I was heavily involved in Phantasy Star 4. I was on the QA team, and my job was to go through and edit all the text and make sure it made sense, and basically be the editor for Phantasy Star 4.
What was that process like?
Lengthy. We weren't given access to files, so I wasn't given a large text file that I could just go in and noodle and be like, oh yeah, that doesn't make sense to a Western user, or oh, here's a grammar, or here's a way to clear this up and make it fit. It was really black box going through the game, finding text, finding those interactions, and then describing what happened, how the text came up, what the text was, and what the text should be. It was quite a process.
Wow. And that was in a spreadsheet, I take it?
That was, what did we use? It was a combination. We would use spreadsheets when there was a lot of it. We were fortunate in that way. But I think we used like some Microsoft product to keep track of all the bugs. I don't believe it's around anymore. I forget what it was called.
That was like 30 years ago, right?
Yes, Ethan, that was like 30 years ago.
Well, it's just...
This was probably 94, 95.
I was about to say, yeah. And I remember that cartridge was $80 when it came out, which if you think about it being the mid-90s, it's just wild, right? Inflation would make that ridiculously expensive today, but they were willing to put a game out at that cost because they knew that there's a core audience who would play it. And if I remember correctly, it required a special chip or special hardware in the cartridge to even run.
Wow. So you know more than me. I was done when it shipped, so I have no idea what it was like, commercial product from the store.
Yeah, it's a really good game and one that I was playing on Nintendo Switch Online actually this year. It's a fun one to pick up. It has lots of cutscenes. It's a game that ages very, very well, I think.
It does. A great story. Very emotional. Even for me working on the game, I thought the story really was impactful.
Well, David, I would wonder, you said that you worked at Sony, Namco, in addition to Sega. So what were the similarities and the differences between working at those three Japanese companies?
So I guess the similarities would be when you're working as an American at a Japanese company, you don't quite have the agency you might otherwise. So that is the first thing you have to learn. One valuable lesson I learned, which when I was young, I kind of pushed back on because I felt it was just wildly political. And that was Nemawashi or Nemawashi. As I age, I realize it's just smart. And Nemawashi is the meeting before the meeting. And it is basically driving consensus with the key players, the stakeholders of any large project, any large decision, making sure that they have what they need and you have what you need. And basically setting those pins up so that you can knock them down when you walk into that executive boardroom and start asking for money. It's a waste of time to get in there and have a no. You want to have productive conversations in that room, but you also want to have a sense of how is this going to go and what do I need to do before I get into that room to make sure that it's successful. And that's something that happens a lot in Japanese company. I think that might have something to do with the pace of how they do things.
So that's a similarity. Are there any things that stood out as different from company to company?
I mean, they have their personalities and they have different levels of executive presence and impact, I think would be a good way to put it. Bandai and Sega, at the times I was there, both were pushing hard to try to make waves in the Western market so that they could balance their global revenue portfolio, right? Sony had more of a singular view of the world as a market. They just couldn't make inroads into the West trying to get phone hardware. When I was at Sony, I was working at Sony Mobile on their hardware projects and their store for mobile free-to-play games. So I think it's almost like a personality-driven thing in terms of the differences.
I'd like to hear a little more about your experience at Sony, particularly since you were focused on kind of mobile, which is, I think a lot of people don't really remember or recall Sony's kind of focus on mobile. They had a handheld that were a mobile device that was focused at the gamer market. It didn't quite take the world by storm. What was it like being inside a large Japanese company that has huge success in games, but is still kind of trying to establish a beachhead in an area that it hadn't really had success before?
Yeah, it was tough. When you look at the mobile market in the West, basically you're going against Apple, you know, largest company in the world, or richest company, I guess, and Samsung, which is a government-backed undertaking, right? And so how do you, as an independent business, you know, a giant conglomerate, certainly, but not a government and not Apple, how do you spend against that? How do you market a product to get the traction that you need to to create success for those products in the Western market? And the answer was, you kind of don't. Unfortunately, 2 weeks after I started at Sony Mobile, they announced a $2 billion goodwill impairment from their purchase of Ericsson. And if you're not familiar with that term, what that means is, oh, we messed up. They overpaid. And so immediately they were behind, right? They're in the red. And so that didn't bode well, which was unfortunate because the hardware was incredible. I had a pad from Sony that I used for 10 years until finally it just couldn't keep up with everything that was happening in apps and the web. But it was a beautiful form factor. I still only, this is a Sony phone here, and I use Sony phones still to this day, even though I haven't worked at the company for 10 years. The form factor's there. It's 120 hertz. It's just great hardware. But getting traction and making a profitable business out of it in the West is tough. Super popular in parts of Europe, super popular in Brazil, and of course Japan. But that's different than having a global success.
Well, I remember being envious of anyone who had the slide-out game controller for the Sony phones. That was the coolest thing. And Chris has heard me say many times before that I wish Apple would do that. If they had an iPhone G that had physical controls, that would be wonderful built into the device. I don't see it happening, but it's such a cool thing. And I'll take that over a folding phone any day. But I even remember finding it attractive, the idea of getting a Sony phone, because that was at first the only place you could do remote play off of a phone instead of the Vita. So they had their own dedicated controller that you would snap onto it. And it was weird to me that they wouldn't make that available everywhere. You would have thought that they would have wanted players to have access to that anywhere they were. But still, that was enough to get me like very, very close to abandoning iPhone for a little bit just to have access to remote play.
Yeah, I was there during that period, and I was super excited about that functionality as well. Of course, early versions of that type of thing don't always go super smooth. But yeah, it was a definite advantage to the hardware. At the same time, they were just very busy. They had a lot of irons in the fire. I also worked on a wristband, right? I worked on a smartphone. I worked on Android TV and mobile games and phones. And so they were just doing so much. They couldn't focus on that aspect. And Sony Mobile, being not a game company, even though they're closely related to SIE and what's going on at PlayStation, and we did some partnerships with them, knowing about it and organizing cross-conglomerate efforts around promoting that one thing is very difficult within a large business.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, you're not going to have everyone behind it at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. It won't be in everyone's interests.
Was the wristband a fitness tracker?
It was, yeah. Yeah, it was great. I really enjoyed it. It was the age of the quantified self. Everybody's talking about, oh, yeah, you know, strap tracking your heartbeat, tracking your sleep, you know, and there was some great software that went along with it. But those devices tended to end up in drawers after 6 months, after the sheen wore off, or maybe after you were getting too much negative feedback about your progress to be the most fit person you could possibly be. People give up on them. It's a tough business.
It's interesting to me which technologies end up becoming a part of your everyday and which ones fall off. Another one that I stopped using after having used it every day for many years was the iPad. Maybe it's because I have a bigger phone, but I just stopped finding a tablet useful between all the other devices I have.
I do still use a tablet, sometimes for gaming, but mostly at night to read before I go to sleep.
To read, yeah.
Against all advice, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I used a tablet for a long time, and it was mostly for reading, and now I read mostly physical media, books, magazines, etc., just because I try to avoid a screen in bed at all costs. But most of the stuff that I would do on a tablet, I find I'm doing on my phone, so gaming, reading, doom scrolling, etc.
So, David, I remember one of the most fun moments I had when I was at Sega was I was looking to try to help wherever I could. And ultimately, I was interested in creative direction and got there at a certain point. But one of those stepping stones was working with you and your boss, looking through all of the proposals that came in for his Dark Materials, the Golden Compass series. And it was so interesting to see all of these design documents and proposals of what these different teams would do for Nintendo Wii, for the DS, for the PlayStation 3, which at the time was super expensive and impossible to find. So it was really fascinating to see how people would take different approaches to this content. And I also remember Rob Leitner, who is focused on licensing at the company at the time, saying this was going to be the next Lord of the Rings. That was the hope, anyway, that this was going to be the huge franchise that would break out and be mass market. So when you were dealing with that, and you were dealing with all these different SKUs, what were your considerations for who you would sign and what scope the game would need to be to actually hit an aggressive timeline?
Yeah, so for those projects, really got to cut my teeth on writing RFPs or requests for proposal. During that period, we had a number of those. We did it for Marvel, and we did it for Dark Materials and some other IP that we were working with. When you look at, and also the philosophy at the time was a little different than it is now. At the time, it was everything with a screen. And so we'd go into a deal and we'd say, hey, we want this for phone, we want this for handheld, we want this for console, we want it for PC, right? And we want it all done, and we all want it to hit this date because it was retail driven at the time, and it needed to come out, it needed to be solid, and it needed to be as good as it could be, right? There was no like, okay, day one patch, right? That just didn't exist. You needed to have a production plan and a developer lined up for each of those SKUs that you felt good about, that you could depend on to hit that hard date. So when you're looking at all of those, you want to try to remove as many variables as you can. And for us, that was about placing as many of those SKUs as possible with the same developer. That meant that developer had to have that expertise across all of those, which reduced the pool of development houses that you could work with if that was your approach. But we felt that working with a developer who would come up to speed on the universe that these games were from, on the approach that Sega wanted to take in terms of how the production would move forward and how the go-to-market would happen. We felt like reducing those communication points were valuable enough to us to maybe not have the best phone developer, the best console developer, the best PC developer, and find someone who could do a good job on all of those, and the ultimate product would be elevated by reducing those variables and focusing our communication efforts with as few partners as possible.
So when Japan was churning out stuff like Bayonetta, obviously You don't have the possibility of hitting that kind of qualitative bar when you're rushing to finish a licensed game. So How did you deal with the Japanese teams in explaining that, look, this is something that is not going to be at the level of game that some of your products with partners get to come out at?
You just have to be clear about the constraints and about the goals and about the opportunity. So they were, you know, obviously very focused on quality and putting the best face forward. It was about just educating the goals of these types of partnerships and this type of product. And, you know, a lot of times it didn't really work out that well. And I think we see that in modern games where there aren't these day and date releases with movies. And there isn't this reliance on trying to line up with the story beats within a tentpole release in a game. At the time, it seemed like it was necessary and would be best for the product. But as we learned over the years, it's probably best if the game comes in of its own and offers something new to fans of that particular IP or universe.
Yeah, it should be an extension of the IP, not like a recapitulation of the base movie or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interactive. It's not linear media. And so take advantage of what that medium brings.
Makes perfect sense. What made less sense to me at the time, and this was the last Golden Compass question I had, but I remember being kind of shocked that there was going to be a PlayStation 3 version. And the reason that surprised me was that machine was brand new that holiday, and it was $700, and it was sold out everywhere with very low promises of restocking. And Golden Compass was a brand clearly targeting children. And it wasn't kids who were buying PlayStation 3 at $700 and queuing in line when they had restocks. So yeah. You're talking about a vanishingly small audience to begin with, just PS3 alone. But then when you say people who are going to play kids' games on PlayStation 3, that I was calculating in my head that what that might be a max audience of hundreds as opposed to even thousands. Like, it's so small. So how is it that that kind of decision gets made and you don't just say, well, this one just obviously doesn't make sense? Is it something that would offend Sony long term if we didn't have their backs on that product? And so it was a relationship thing or what? Because it didn't make sense.
Yeah, that is part of it. Hardware manufacturers want new games on their hardware to help them sell it. There was no foregone conclusion that it would be so hard to get, although, you know, in hindsight, sure. And also when you're releasing a product on a platform, you're looking at a several year envelope. So you can't, even though it's going to be impacted by the install base at launch, you're looking at a larger base because of the time horizon that you intend to sell that product on the platform.
Okay. So there is some calculus going on that goes beyond the, we're going to sell X number of units on this device.
Yeah, it's portfolio management, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
So now Sonic Racing, which is coming out next week, is very, very exciting. And one of the things that excites people most is that Nickelodeon brands are coming to it. So you have Ninja Turtles, you have SpongeBob, and that's really cool. The Turtles in particular got my son really excited when he found out about that yesterday. And what's interesting is based on different times in your career, you could have been on either side of the discussion table for that type of product. So you were at Sega, of course, but you were also at Nickelodeon, and you were working on brands like Turtles, right?
So not Turtles so much. So my involvement with the Nickelodeon brand, I was on the addictinggames.com team.
Oh, and, okay.
Yeah, which is a little different. They would occasionally let us approach those IPs, but they were a little wary of our approach to content, because if you remember Addicting Games, it was fast, it was in your face, it was a little sloppy, it was very youth oriented.
It was like the Roblox of its time.
Absolutely. So everything was in Flash, which is a very approachable development platform. You didn't have to have a lot of skill. You could put something short out. And we released 12 games a week, which is nothing compared to Roblox. But at the time, it was, you know, it was quite the breakneck pace. And eventually, we did have the audience. I think we had 25 million monthly, which was pretty good at the time. So we were getting attention from the higher ups, and we'd occasionally get a chance to work on or bring those games to our platform. But mostly we were concerned with flying outhouses and dress up games and being naughty and riding motorcycles.
What did you learn or what surprised you from your learnings about content when the range was that broad?
So data is very important. One of the advantages we had at Addicting Games, and this was new, I think, for the industry, was being able to look at the play patterns of our players and see things like, oh, this particular type of game becomes popular at 11 a.m. And you're able to sort of tease things out of the data that you get from the platform, like, oh, okay, these are moms that came home and the kids are at school, so they're playing Mahjong. Hey, it looks like this is lunchtime. These games are popular at lunchtime. And then there's sort of the, oh, people are in computer class playing these kinds of games. And then you get a different type of gameplay patterns after school. Because we knew our players were young, and we leaned into that. We appreciated the immaturity. It allowed us a breadth of content that we could provide and a very playful approach to the types of games that we made. And so I think that was unusual for the industry at the time. It was a packaged product for the most part, except for what was happening in mobile as it was gaining traction at that point. But with this data, we could build games for those players. So a lot of our stuff was licensed. We would just have people license us their game and we'd put it up. But then we'd take the learnings from watching the play patterns for these titles and build our own games. So that was the advantage of that time and working in that way, was the quick turnover of data about a particular play experience and what we could take from how people were interacting with that experience.
Yeah, it's an interesting, having that platform is an interesting place to be, right? Because you're able to kind of see and try to make predictions, and because the timeline to get games out is so quick, you're able to kind of develop a hypothesis and get something out and test it. So that must have been a pretty interesting place to be. And I'm curious, what kind, I guess for 12 games that you shipped a week, what was that? How was that planned? Like, what did it look like? Like, some of its stuff, this is going to be a banger, we know it's going to hit. And how much room for experimentation was there when you were doing that work?
Yeah, the prognosis on something hitting kind of was the experimentation. We really didn't care what it was. If it hit a note with us, we would promote it. So if we played it and it gave us joy, and it made us happy to be a gamer, then we were going to promote it. It didn't matter what it was. If it was Michael Vick's Dog Trainer, if it was Britney's Bad Hair Day, if it was, you know, Naughty School Child, you know, whatever it was, if we got joy out of it when we were testing it and going through it, then that's what we promoted. We didn't have an agenda beyond that, and just trying to make the best games possible that we knew our players would enjoy. That's what made that time in my career really special, and one of the best memories I have was just the opportunity to be creative and to try to entertain, no holds barred.
Yeah, it's kind of taking it back to the playground, which I think there's a certain level of satisfaction there, right?
Yes.
Excellent. So you mentioned that you were kind of siloed to a certain degree at Addicting Games, but every once in a while you were able to look at or consider Nickelodeon IP. Can you think of an example of where you were able to introduce SpongeBob to Addicting Games or some other Nick tie-up?
So Nickelodeon, yeah. So one of the things about Addicting Games was owned by Nickelodeon, who's owned by MTV, who's owned by Viacom. And so within that sort of draconic corporate structure, a lot of things were out of bounds when it came to established IP from other companies within the conglomerate. SpongeBob being one of those. SpongeBob is an amazing IP. There is a room full of people in New York that do nothing but license SpongeBob, and it makes mad money even to this day. And at the time, it was probably peaking. So it was difficult for us to influence how that happened, because they're very careful about how SpongeBob was presented and the games that we was in. We worked with a sister company called Shockwave. Shockwave is a little higher, a little more highbrow, a little more mature. And so they would get cracks at bringing SpongeBob games there first, but none of us were able to create a SpongeBob game from scratch.
So what caused the end of Addicting Games?
Oh, that's a sore subject. It has to do with corporate dynamics and personalities and fiefdoms. Part of it was probably Steve Jobs. He hated Flash, and corporate types, you know, tend to listen to these luminaries, right? But mobile was happening. So right at the end there, brought in a guy named Gary Kitchen, brilliant old school gamer.
Oh, Atari 2600, right?
Yeah. He was like early, you know, one of the first 5-10 people at Activision. So
yeah,
really knows his stuff. He came in, brought David Crane in with him. I don't know if you knew David Crane.
Pitfall.
Oh, yeah. Pitfall.
Yes, sir. Yeah. And they came in, and one of the initiatives that came out of that was going to mobile. The projects that really took hold there with these guys was taking our value proposition to mobile. So Addicting Games had several mobile games out, and they'd been doing well. But our model was, hey, let's take our most popular games from the site, do some extra content, package it up, get it on mobile, and sell it for, you know, $3 or whatever. Gary wanted to bring the whole value proposition of Addicting Games to mobile. So we created an extensible compilation app, and we put 20 games in there, some of our fan favorites, some new stuff, some like classic games. And that actually did really well. We were number one in the App Store for 4 weeks until this little app called Facebook came out, and then we kind of dropped off after that. But the weird thing that happened after that was they decided that they would really ramp down on Addicting Games. There was a personality that was in the business working down in LA that really wanted to lean into an MMO pet project that they had. And so resources kept getting siphoned off and siphoned off. And then they decided they would just close the San Francisco office where all this magic was happening. And they shipped some people off to New York, some to LA, and a lot of people just got laid off. And that was kind of how it ended, on a very successful note, but, you know, also very sad.
Yeah, it's always sad to see that, because there are these pockets of incredible creativity that happen with certain platforms. You clearly were riding that crest. I always think about mobile phones during the dollar era, where you had the Doodle Jumps and Angry Birds and Where's My Water and all these incredible experimental games that were so fun. And when things consolidate, when people figure out what really makes the most money, you wind up with Match 3 and 4X and gacha games, and that's it. And that's kind of a bummer, because the market can be so much more than that. But I'm glad at least you were able to bring a lot of that happiness to players for the time in which it was possible.
Absolutely. I've run into this a few times in my career. People who are outside of the industry always want to know what the formula is for a hit game. And we heard that a lot from Viacom. What's the formula? And, you know, it's hard to get past that mindset.
There is no one formula. Mm-mm. That's the answer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, David, it's been so fun to catch up and talk about the old days and learn a lot about your history that we didn't know. So thank you so much for joining us, and we hope you join us again sometime.
Yeah, it's been fun. Thanks, David.
Yeah, thanks, guys. This was a real treat, and I look forward to speaking with you again somewhere and kicking around some more.
Great. And everyone who listened, thanks so much for getting to the end of the episode, and we will talk to you next week.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye, y'all.